When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Fails. Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 Years' War.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War One.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916
to the crisis. Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered. Alternative history is one of those things that people seem to either really love or really hate. There's always been a great appetite for alternative history. Even in the late 19th century, some seriously impressive novels were released, detailing the end of days as one's fleet were destroyed by a surprise attack, a large-scale invasion of Europe which no one saw coming was launched, or a governmental change brought about by a cataclysmic war and a titanic struggle between the forces of good and evil took place. I, for one, have always found alternative history really interesting, mainly because of the eras I delve into and their population by a host of important characters and figures. It often has me wondering what may or may not have changed had a certain figure acted or not acted in this way or that. The idea that if a certain figure had gotten up in a different mood and done things in a different way, those issues provide ample opportunities to speculate about what might have been. Considering this, and considering the interest I've always had in this aspect of history, I thought it'd be fun to basically unleash an episode on a given what-if topic in the discipline, with a few caveats that I hope will make the whole process all the more interesting for you guys. The first point has to do with the actual topic coming under consideration today, which you probably have discerned from the actual title of the episode. It is the question of what would have happened had Gavrilo Princip missed, instead of actually hitting and killing Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his unfortunate wife Sophie on the 28th of June, 1914. We all know what happened afterwards, wink wink, nudge nudge, July Crisis Anniversary Project, and while I do resent the theory of causation which states that this assassination automatically led to the First World War, I do appreciate that without the act, everything would have progressed differently. So this will be our main focus in this multi-part episode. The second point is exactly how I'll go about tackling the question. This will not be a Twilight Histories style episode for a number of reasons. Well, I know my limits and I know what I'm good and bad at, and I'd neither have the time nor the ability to produce something of that kind of quality. However, this means that I can undertake a project here which is more in line with what I personally prefer to listen to if I ever come across alternative history podcasts. So the formula today will be much like my own podcast style. Once the background intro sound plays, I'll be talking to you about what happened after the morning of the 28th of June 1914, as though such events actually happened. In other words, I won't be creating an atmospheric world, I'll be recounting the historical events as they occurred according to my vivid imagination and how I believe history would have progressed without Princip's success. In this way, you'll be introduced to a world which is more focused on the events and people that were directly affected, as well as how it went on to change our world, and I do think this fits in more with my style. I'll essentially be pretending that everything I say to you took place. So don't get confused if you find yourself thinking that certain dates are wrong or certain characters aren't in their right places, though as far as possible I have used a great deal of real people through this experiment. It should be said, finally, that this is very much an experiment, as I've obviously never done this before, so if you enjoy this experience, make sure you let me know and I'll absolutely consider covering another. In the discussion episode between Jordan Harbour and myself which follows this, we get into additional what-if scenarios, but I figured that Princip's act is one of the most towering what-ifs I've ever come across in the last 5 years of podcasting, so I wanted to try and do it justice myself. I hope you enjoy it then, and you're ready for something different, as I take you to the 28th of June, 1914. The motorcade returned to the road. It seemed incredible that such lapses in security should occur around the heir to the Habsburg throne, but such were the state of things in 1914 Sarajevo that Franz Ferdinand now wished merely to bring the whole visit to an end. His itinerary had at least been cut short. They were to visit the earlier victims of a terrorist bomb attack and hospital, rather than visit the city's barracks as originally planned. Into the third car, Franz and his wife climbed, with the governor of Sarajevo, Oskar Potjurek, in the front seat beside the driver. With two cars in front and two cars behind, the parade moved down the Apple Quay, but the police chief had neglected to inform the driver in front of the change in itinerary. As the front, and therefore second cars, attempted to reverse, having turned up the wrong street, Franz and Sophie's car was stuck in place until the motorcade righted itself. It was then that the governor of Sarajevo, Oskar Potjurek, who indeed was sat in the car with Franz and Sophie, noticed him. He was a thin, dark-haired and altogether unwell-looking man, and he was stepping away from the seats outside Schiller's Bakery, along the shopping street nearby, and he was walking steadily towards him. But it wasn't so much the surroundings as the man himself and what he held in his hand. In his outstretched hand was a firearm, and as he got closer, Potjurek could tell it was a Belgian-made Fabrique Nationale model 1910 semi-automatic pistol. His finger was squeezing the trigger, and the weapon was pointed in the direction of the Archduke. Potjurek opened his mouth to scream a warning, just as Franz turned his head towards the would-be assassin. A loud shot was heard, and then another. Suddenly citizens began yelling and running in panic. Potjurek called to Franz to get down, and as he did so he heard an audible groan. A policeman had been struck and had collapsed to the ground. In a panic, Potjurek looked first to the assailant, who was struggling with a passerby for his weapon, and then to the Archduke. Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie were unharmed, but shaken. It had been a very close-run thing. It was then that Potjurek realized that he himself had been hit, but in the shoulder. Franz looked at his wound with concern, and Potjurek straightened up before getting out of the car. "It is nothing," Potjurek called after the Archduke. "You both stay here." Civilians would later attest to Potjurek's bravery on that day, as an eyewitness recounted that Potjurek, almost without realizing, had lunged in front of the Archduke once he heard the shots. They had been fired by a Bosnian Serb by the name of Gavrilo Princip. Princip had fired one shot at the car, which struck the outstretched Potjurek in the shoulder, only to fire at a policeman when he noted the latter coming towards him with his own weapon. A Bosnian bystander, after noting Princip was a danger to all involved, struggled with him for the gun and overpowered him. Princip took his cyanide pill, but it was old and it only made him vomit. He crumpled in a heap outside the bakery in which he had just purchased a sandwich. Potjurek had to call for help to prevent the citizens passing by from beating Princip to death. He wanted to bring this terrorist in for questioning and see who was behind the whole scheme. The following days were a blur for the Habsburg administration in Sarajevo. All the terrorists involved that day, from Princip himself to his peers, of whom all survived their own suicide attempts, were later captured and brought in for questioning. Amidst their line of query, it was discovered just how far up the chain of command the assassination plot actually went. A Serbian colonel, Dragutin Dmitrijevic, codenamed Apis, had provided the assassins with all the materials they would need to be successful. A major, Tankosic, was another man who was involved, and he happened to be the head of Serbian military intelligence, but that wasn't all. Tankosic, through a curious chain of command, had both received and passed notes to individuals ranging from Nikola Pešić, the Serbian Prime Minister, to Nikolai Hartwig, the Russian ambassador to Serbia. Under both international and direct Austrian pressure, Belgrade was compelled to cooperate. On the 30th of June 1914, amidst a great reception in Vienna, Franz Ferdinand received Oskar Poturek, the man whom he credited with saving his life and thus saving the future of the Habsburg monarchy. Still sporting a bandage and sling over his injured shoulder, the governor of Sarajevo, Oskar Poturek, became an overnight sensation in the European and eventually world media, upheld as the Habsburg loyalist who had been willing to lay down his life for his beloved royal family. The news inspired marches in support of the monarchy in Vienna and across Austria, as the great admiration and pride of the Habsburg citizen was wildly expressed and, of course, encouraged. While presenting the award to Poturek, Franz Ferdinand announced that a Congress of Powers were due to meet in Vienna on the 2nd of July to discuss the recent events in Sarajevo, and that Poturek would be the Habsburg representative at this Congress. The Congress in Vienna, held 99 years after the original Congress of Vienna, which had ended the Napoleonic Wars, served as a great showcase for Habsburg prestige. One clerk working at the event was later quoted as saying, "Before Sarajevo, the dual monarchy seemed to be on death's door. Now it seems as though, by trying to kill it, Serbia has made itself an enemy not merely of the Habsburgs, but of the general European peace." The Congress involved all of the great powers, to be attended by ambassadors or other important statesmen, and conducted mostly behind closed doors, for fear of another assassination attempt. Through German pressure, directly authorized by Kaiser Wilhelm II, a great friend and ally of Franz Ferdinand and his wife, the other Congress members were encouraged to see Sarajevo as an assault on the monarchical principle as much as it was an assassination attempt on the Habsburg heir. It became immensely difficult for the Russian attendee at the Congress, as Russia had no permanent ambassador to Austria at this point in time, to argue for a policy of clemency towards Serbia. International opinion was building against the Serbs, and when it emerged that Nikolai Hartwig, the Russian ambassador in Belgrade, had been implicated, further scandal was brought upon St. Petersburg. The French representative at the Congress of Vienna, who in fact was the French Premier, René Viviani, was under pressure from Paris to reduce the damage of the scandal on Russia's reputation and that of France by making a point to stand visibly aloof from such schemes, while Viviani also had to find a way to appear to back the Russians up. It was a difficult line to tread, though, particularly when confronted by the picture of Habsburg patriotism and confidence that Governor Poturek represented. The story of his act of heroism had gripped the imagination and attentions of the media, and paintings of the act were already being commissioned. While at the Congress in Vienna over the 2nd to the 4th of July 1914, it was learned that the Russian ambassador to Serbia had been arrested by the Serbian mop-up operation in Belgrade. International pressure, it seemed, appeared to be taking its toll. Nikola Pešić was said to be the next political casualty of the scandal, though it was rumoured that the old Serbian statesman wouldn't go quietly. Again, Poturek cut a dashing figure, recalling the day's events and insisting on a moment's silence for the policeman whom Princip had shot and who later died of his wounds. The Bosnian people, Poturek exclaimed, would not stand for such an attack on their honourable servicemen. He hoped that the assembled representatives would see the need for justice to those both living and dead. The British ambassador to Vienna, Sir Maurus de Bunsen, was especially sympathetic to Poturek's appeals. British Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey was said to be preparing a memo back in London for Cabinet. Upon the outrage committed by the Serbian terrorists, and without any clear information on how far up the chain of command the conspiracy precisely went, Grey published a memo calling for calm and urging Serbian cooperation. The Home Rule crisis in Ireland was said to have been especially distracting for Grey and others in Cabinet. John Morley, a member of Cabinet on the Board of Trade, was said to have been especially critical about the Russian role in the attempt, and the general mood of sympathy in Britain prevented any direct involvement by London in any alternative schemes. The most straightforward option was to urge calm and sensible discussion, which de Bunsen, as the representative of Britain in Vienna, was on hand to organise. He liaised between the Russian representative and Potiorek, and gleaned from Viviani and the Italian representative the appropriate cooperation. The German ambassador in the Congress, Leonard von Chersky, who was also the German ambassador to Vienna, was said to have particularly appreciated the British support in acquiring satisfaction for its ally. Kaiser Wilhelm II had been told of the near miss while engaging in naval manoeuvres with his British counterparts, and the apparent calm of the Congress meant that both fleets remained in close proximity as the events continued over the 2nd to the 4th of July. As a sign of thanks for the Anglo-German cooperation displayed during the Congress, Kaiser Wilhelm was invited to dine in London on the 7th of July, ostensibly to show a unified commitment towards European peace by the British and Germans. Wilhelm was well received by British crowds, and the affair would later be immortalised as the Two Cousins Dinner, an event of mutual peacemaking which both Germany and Britain could be proud of. The Times talked up Wilhelm's attachment to his late grandmother Queen Victoria, and Wilhelm's English was said to be perfect as he dined with his royal cousin George V in private. Much was made of the dual efforts at acquiring fair and reasonable satisfaction by the Anglo-German representatives in Vienna, which again the media latched onto as a symbol of the warming relationship between the once tense powers. The Anglophile German Chancellor, Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg, was said by historians to have seen the Two Cousins Dinner as his greatest achievement in Anglo-German diplomacy. Hollweg had petitioned for it amongst his peers as the best opportunity to capitalise on the positive feelings of cooperation between the two countries after many years of tension. At one point it seemed as though Sir Edward Grey, renowned since for his anti-German and pro-Russian sentiments, would block the German offer, made as it had been through the other renowned Anglophile and German ambassador to Britain, Prince Lichnowsky. However, Grey's policy line was in a weak position after the Russians and Serbs had evidently come off so badly in an assassination attempt on the now glorified Archduke and his heroic saviour, Governor Potiorek. At the same time, this Anglo-German cooperation had been anticipated with the so-called Haldane mission in years past, when the naval race was reaching its climax and the Lord Chancellor, Richard Haldane, had been sent to ease tensions. That mission, occurring over 1912 and 13, hadn't succeeded, even with Haldane's pro-German sentiments, but it had created a precedent. This time around, distracted with affairs in Ireland and encouraged by mutual cooperation which had taken place in the previous Balkan Wars, this Two Cousins Dinner seemed like a natural progression, particularly with the further Anglo-German cooperation seen during the Congress in Vienna over the 2nd to the 4th of July. Subsequent efforts to reconcile the standoffish and belligerent personality of the Kaiser with those of some elements of his military were made especially difficult by historians, owing to the genuine displays of affection and concern towards first his firm friend Franz Ferdinand, and then his cousin George V. Wilhelm, it was later concluded, viewed the Congress and the Two Cousins Dinner as the best opportunity to repair the damage inflicted upon Anglo-German friendship over the previous years. A current statue of his in Berlin depicts the Kaiser with a dove resting on his outstretched left hand and a saber sheathed by his right. At the foot of the statue, marking the record-setting 54 years that Wilhelm served as German Emperor upon his death in 1944, it is inscribed, "And the greatest gift he gave them was not war, but honour and glory in peace." Peace indeed was the desire of the Kaiser's cousin George V, though the stance of the other cousin, Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, was less certain. These events would later paint a neat bundle of gradually building displays of Anglo-German cooperation, which historians would later point to as proof that the two empires could never have fought on opposite sides in the coming war. Though there is a school of thought which argues that there was no coherent aim in the German Foreign Office in the lead up to the Great War. I tend to argue with this latter view, but historians are mostly unanimous that the combined acts of Anglo-German cooperation, in the Congress in Vienna, and the cordial, some would even say warm, displays of friendship displayed in the course of the two cousins' dinner, confirmed the foreign policies of both states going forward. While facing questioning on the 10th of July, 1914, the Russian ambassador to Belgrade, Nikolai Hartwig, died from a sudden heart attack while in Serbian custody. The Serbian police chief insisted that Hartwig had died due to stress and his general poor state of health, but St. Petersburg insisted on a full investigation being launched. Both blamed the other, as Hartwig was presented in Serbia as the man who led all true Serbs astray and took his secrets to the grave, while in Russia, Nikolai Hartwig was the man of the Serbs, whose kindness had been taken advantage of before he was thrown under the bus. The Tsar in particular was said to have been furious at Serbian accusations, and he insisted that the results of the previous Congress in Vienna had to stand, even if they were unpopular in Belgrade. These results included demands that Serbia cooperate fully with the joint European investigation, which was to follow, and that Austria require compensation from the Serbian government in a form later to be defined, as well as an official apology from the Serbian government for not halting those Bosnian Serb operatives sooner. Over the following month, Dragutin Dmitrievich was arrested and he would eventually be hanged. At this, Vienna would declare itself satisfied. The hanging was said to have been secretly insisted upon by the Austrians, as per the demands they had given through the Congress, though it had not been part of the published documents. As the Serbs committed their own investigations, the result of the interrogations of the Sarajevo group provided valuable information, and this group were also hanged, Princip himself being the last man to the gallows. Franz Ferdinand was said to have been particularly keen to gain this measure of satisfaction from the Serbs, as it was rumoured that Konrad von Hotzendorf, the chief of the general staff in the Habsburg army and navy, and a long-time advocate of war against Serbia, continued to pester the emperor Franz Josef to launch a surprise war against Belgrade. Yet the Habsburg emperor had been swayed by the anti-war party, thanks largely to the sheer weight of the arguments of that party and those Habsburg statesmen within it, which included the Hungarian minister-president Stefan Tisza. Leopold von Berchtold, the Habsburg foreign minister, as well as that aforementioned Hungarian counterpart Stefan Tisza, would tenaciously block the demands of Hotzendorf and those within the war party, and Franz Ferdinand counted himself within the anti-war camp, especially as European opinion remained determinedly pro-Habsburg, and as the Congress actually gained Austria the satisfaction it desired. In the case of her rivals, both in Russia and in Serbia, though, affairs seemed to be unfolding far less smoothly. With Serbian Prime Minister Nikola Pešić refusing to vacate his position and his supporters rallying around him, it seemed as though the country might descend into civil war. Opponents of Pešić's regime and a large number of critics of the new Serbian monarchy seemed to go hand in hand. It became apparent by the last week of July 1914 that the Serbian king, Peter, backed Pešić, and many believed that he refused to allow Pešić to stand down. Since 1903, when a bloody coup had brought him to power, King Peter had enjoyed varying degrees of popularity. The Balkan Wars had significantly added to his prestige, but amidst the rumours surging around following Sarajevo, the king was said to have been implicated in the plot. Some historians have since deduced that, owing to Peter's support of the previously implicated Pešić, that the king was in fact at least partially responsible for the assassination attempt, while others are less certain. As the records were burned shortly after the war, it has become difficult to determine either way who was precisely responsible. But one thing which was certain by the final days of July 1914 was that Serbia seemed to be tearing itself apart from within. The diehards among Pešić's inner circle and those of King Peter were at this point believed to have coined the idea of a short, sharp war against decadent Austria. The plan was almost immediately scuppered by the opposition in Serbia, led by the former ambassador to France, Milenko Radomir Vesnić. Vesnić had originally allied himself politically with Pešić, but since his strong performance, all things considered, in the recent Congress of Vienna, as he had represented Serbia at that Congress, Vesnić was seen as the best candidate to succeed Pešić now. Serbian elections, set for the 14th of August 1914, meant that Pešić could, if he desired, wait for the public to choose and attempt to sit out the scandal, although it remained to be seen if he could weather that storm. A firm advocate of Slav unity and pan-Slavist ideas, it was hoped that Vesnić would be able to repair the now shaky relationship which the Serbs maintained with Russia, after it had virtually fallen apart following Nikolai Hartwig's death on the 10th of July. Yet, just as Vesnić hoped to patch things up and persuade Pešić to stand down quietly, affairs in Russia were proceeding at a far less straightforward pace. The failure of the assassination attempt had hit Sergei Sazonov, Russian foreign minister, like a bomb. Immediately, he had cabled to his allies in government and prepared them to formulate a response. Sazonov was certain that Vienna would attempt to blame the incident on Russia, but when such blame never came, the veteran foreign minister meekly passed on his warmest wishes to Franz Ferdinand and the hero of Sarajevo, as Oskar Potiorek was now called. When it was learned that a congress in Vienna was being discussed, Sazonov initially didn't approve. It was, he believed, merely an opportunity for the Habsburgs to parade their hero in front of the crowds yet again. Yet as the consensus seemed to paint it as a good idea, he would relent, and he argued that the Russian ambassador to Germany should attend to represent St. Petersburg. It was only on the 5th of July, when he learned of the negative impact of the Congress, that Sazonov was said to have urged private talks take place, perhaps between Germany and Britain, to ensure that Serbian sovereignty was not disrespected. The French representative at the Congress in Vienna, René Viviani, was noted resignedly by the Russian attendee at that Congress to have appeared somewhat disinterested in the Russian general interest. It was rumoured that he endured deep political conflicts with Raymond Poincaré, who was, at the time, the French president. For the next few days, Sazonov's options seemed limited. Following Nikolai Hartwig's death, however, everything seemed to change. Subsequent records demonstrate the extent to which the event soured Russian opinions of Serbs across the world. When it was learned that Hartwig had been implicated and roughed up during the investigation, Sazonov attempted to press the Serbs for more information, but he could not get a replacement ambassador into Belgrade for at least a fortnight, and so he had to mostly rely on the French and Italians for further information. This diplomatic incident was underlined by the fact that Serbia now seemed to be persona non grata in Europe at this stage, not to mention the fact that it was slipping into civil war, with Pešić and his king refusing to budge. Sazonov appreciated that it would be difficult to persuade his Tsar to advocate a firm course of action in support of the Serbs, especially as news of the two cousins' dinner also filtered in from London. Tsar Nicholas was said to have been outraged at the fact that his two cousins, Kaiser Wilhelm II and George V, had met in private for a dinner without him. Supposedly, historians have said since that the Tsar saw it as a personal snub. Although the month of July 1914 was a busy one for him, with a long-awaited visit from the French president, Raymond Poincaré, expected to take much of the middle part of the month and therefore much of his time away from him, only ending itself on the 23rd of July when Poincaré sailed home, the Tsar still felt miffed. Regarding the French president's visit, accompanied as he was by a reluctant René Viviani, who may have felt some sting of resentment from the Russians that he interacted with, all talk had been about the Serbs and how the Tsar must get a handle on them before they ruined the Franco-Russian plans and significantly alter European opinion. For Raymond Poincaré, Germany remained the most glaring threat, and he had only recently forced through a military law in France which would scrape down to the bottom of the barrel of French manpower in order to keep on level with Germany, though the military bill had been unpopular with most Frenchmen. It was rumoured that the Tsar was tiring of the military requirements of the French alliance, and Poincaré was there to make sure that he stood firm. For his part, Sazonov was regularly visited by experienced generals and military men in the first 2 weeks of July, but their repeated urgings to crush Austria before Serbia collapsed did not find an agreeable ear in Sazonov, at least not yet. It was then learned that Pešić was under pressure to stand down, and that the prominent Russophile, Milenko Vesnić, was destined to replace him. Shortly after cabling Belgrade to inquire about Peisic's status on the 29th of July 1914, Sazonov was then risen from his bed on the early morning of the 30th of July. It was the Serbian ambassador with news that Nikola Peisic had stood down after all. Thus, St. Petersburg could be expecting a memo from the new Serbian Prime Minister within a few hours. And that, folks, is the end of the first part of this alternative history episode, entitled What If Gavrilo Princip Missed? I hope you'll check your feed for part 2, which was released the same day, and that you'll join me to find out what I believe would have happened next in this theoretical scenario. Thanks for listening, guys, and I'll be seeing you all soon.